Let me tell you a little bit about Professor Matty Weitzman. He has a Philly connection, I should let you know. His son is a graduating senior, is that right? There he is in the back, at Haverford. And we're happy to have him here in Philadelphia. He's a principal research fellow at the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle Eastern and African Studies at Tel Aviv University. And he's taught throughout the world at Emory University in Brandeis here in America. And he's also lectured throughout the United States, Israel, Turkey, and Morocco. His specialty, as you surely know by now, is in the countries of North Africa, and especially on their indigenous Berber populations. He's authored a number of books about the Middle East, including one just this year that was published, entitled The Return to History, Berber Identity and the Challenge to North African States. You'll also be able to read his writings periodically throughout the year. He publishes a monthly Mideast Monitor column in the Jerusalem Report, and he's a frequent contributor to the forums, Middle East Quarterly. In fact, he has an article coming up in the next edition entitled Is Morocco Immune to Upheaval? So please welcome William, Professor Bruce Matty Weitzman.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. When you speak about a Philly connection, actually, it immediately came to my mind is a young boy in Syracuse, New York, late at night, fiddling with the dial to get in the wintertime, in order to get WCAU so I could listen to the 76ers game. Because in those days, the 76ers had just migrated from Syracuse. And so it was traumatic, of course, for me because my team left. But they were still the same players, and I was still a big fan, and that was a long, long time ago. But some of you probably remember those days. And I remember that was really, for me, that was Philadelphia. Andy Musser, Sonny Hill, and Al Meltzer, in fact, who was a relative, actually a distant cousin of mine. So hadn't even thought about that, but there you are. Back to the matter at hand. I hope everybody can hear me, and I hope it's the right volume level. The year 2011 may well be remembered as a transformative one in the history of modern Arab states. It's a year, a moment in which societies across the Middle East and North Africa essentially kicked back, if you will, after decades of unbridled domination by authoritarian state structures. Now, the initial outcomes, of course, of this phenomena vary from place to place, and the verdict is still very much out. And one can certainly already say that those who were in the vanguard of the initial protests, I actually prefer the term uprising, Intifada, even in the broad sense, uprising, as opposed to the term Arab Spring, which just sounds too soft, if you will, or too flower child type. Whatever we call it, those who were in the vanguard, the youth, the 20 somethings, the Facebook generation, the SMSers, the internets, the internet savvy generation, those who really captured everyone's sympathies, I think, instinctively, from Tahrir Square in Egypt, in Tunisia, of course. Those people have been replaced, if you ask, according to my understanding, they've been replaced by a variety of groups, and most important of whom are Islamist movements. And we'll speak more about that. But my intent here is to talk telegraphically about the North Africa region. The term Maghreb should be familiar to some or to most of you. Maghreb, the term for Arab Islamic West, and the Maghreb states are Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya. Look at your map here. And Mauritania, just to the south of Morocco and the western Sahara. Technically, of course, Egypt also belongs to North Africa. It's on the African continent. It's in the north of Africa. It borders on the Mediterranean. It's divided from sub-Saharan Black Africa by the Sahara Desert. But historically, culturally, geopolitically, Egypt belongs more to the Arab-Islamic East, the Mashrik. And so therefore, I'd like to not spend any amount of time of my prepared remarks talking about what's happening in Egypt, but in the Q&A, we can relate perhaps to Egypt as well. So I want to talk about telegraphically the events that are taking place in the Maghreb countries and the North African states in the wake of the upheavals, and questions that I want to raise and at least hopefully provide partial answers to include which states have the best prospects for promoting effective democratization, what's the strength of the Islamist movements in each of these countries, are Morocco and Algeria in pre-revolutionary situations? These are countries which have not yet experienced the upheavals, the protests, mass protests, and regime changes that we've witnessed in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt. Are these countries, what are their prospects, that is, say, in Morocco and Algeria? What are the chances that Libya may turn into something much worse than one could even imagine? Can Libya become another Somalia? Can it be a safe haven for jihadis, etc., for al-Qaeda types? What's the strength of more liberal currents? And that includes women's groups, secular intellectuals, the Berber identity movement, etc. And in fact, how might the events in Morocco impact upon other Middle East monarchies to the east, to the Gulf, and to Jordan, the Middle East monarchy club? So I'm going to raise touch on all those questions, if you will, and hopefully stimulate some thinking, and we can and provide partial answers. Now, still setting the stage here for our discussion, the Maghreb, with its particular mix, its ethnic, linguistic, the type of Islamic practice, its colonial experience, all those things together make it a different place than even a separate unit, if you will, from the broader Middle East. Really, because of the French connection, historically, Americans didn't spend too much time thinking about North Africa. There was contact with North Africans. In fact, Morocco was the first country to recognize the United States of America back in the late 18th century. We think about the wars of the Barbary Coast. Those of you familiar with the Marines hymn, the first line of the battle hymn of the Marines, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, referring to the battles between the pirates, and the North African local potentates who were struggling on the seas with American merchant ships and with fledgling U.S. Navy. And of course, the Americans were involved in World War II in North Africa. We mentioned that earlier, and some of us were talking during the lunch. I mean, American troops fighting in Libya, fighting in Tunisia, landing in Casablanca in 1942. But yet, North Africa has pretty much always been a place that Americans didn't pay much attention to. That it was mainly a French, a part of the French zone, if you will. But clearly, especially in an interconnected world, what happens in one place can reverberate in many other places. And this is what happened, of course, in Tunisia, of all places. It's in Tunisia where the spark was lit for this phenomenon of region-wide uprising or tsunami of popular protests that had been cascading back and forth across the region. And it was lit in a very unlikely place, and by in a forgotten town in southern Tunisia, with a suicide, self-immolation by an unemployed vegetable seller who back in December. And this, of all things, is what sparked the events that have taken place in the last year. Now, hence, whatever happens in North Africa, we have to assume that there are implications for the broader Middle East and for Western interests and for American interests. And after all, North Africa is geopolitically significant, strategically and economically. It's, as you can see on your map, it straddles the Mediterranean, the entrance to the Mediterranean from the west. It's just across, literally, almost literally a stone's throw from Europe. Its borders, on the Atlantic as well. Algeria is carbon rich, petroleum resources. Libya as well. All of these things make North Africa significant for Western interests and even for American interests. Even though, fair enough, it is not the most important area for American interests. It's not the most vital area, but nonetheless, what happens there does count. Now, contemporary Maghrebi societies face a host of political, social, and economic challenges. And they vary from place to place. There are some common themes. Let me just talk about a few, and then we'll get down to some more details. There are large demographic pressures, overwhelmingly youthful population. That combines with economic pressures. These are countries which are not competitive in the world markets. They've not witnessed a takeoff in terms of their productive capacity. Since it's not East Asia, there's no East Asian miracle that took place in North Africa, and hence... those who led the protests were people with some modern education and who were feeling blocked in terms of their own advancement because of these pressures, these economic difficulties. There are 80 million persons approximately in these North African states, and 50% of them or more are under the age of 30. That creates an enormous amount of stress on the employment sector, on the health sector, on the educational sector, and hence makes it very, very difficult for governments to develop the proper policies to handle these matters. And the fact is that there is also a legacy of authoritarian governments and of violence in the North African region, both from the state and from opposition movements. In that regard, it's especially true in Algeria, which witnessed explosion of violence, of civil strife in the 90s. We see the kind of violence that is taking place in Libya. Tunisia, much less. There's a heavy-handed authoritarian regime, but not with a place with a legacy of violent social strife, and Morocco somewhere in between. Now, what about some specifics here? With regard to the challenges in North African states, there's a question of legitimacy for governments. One of the leading scholars in North Africa talked about the need for North African states to recontract with their societies. A half a century after independence, elites that led the countries to independence that gave them a lot of legitimacy, but after a certain number of years, decades, there's a new generation. They don't know. They don't remember Joseph, if you will, or to use the biblical saying. What have you done for me lately? Basically, and these governments didn't have a lot to show for themselves. Algeria lost its legitimacy first and was plunged into horrific violence in the 1990s. Tunisia lost it in this last decade or so, ultimately leading to the overthrow of the autocratic president, Ben Ali. In Morocco, the monarchy has some legitimacy, but it still has to work. It's not enough for the king to say, I'm the descendant of the prophet, and I'm the religious leader of the community, as well as the political leader, and that's all fine and good, but there still have to be results. You can't just, nobody just bows down and says, then kisses the hand of the king and says, that's it, I have nothing more, you can do whatever you want. It doesn't work like that in the Moroccan monarchy. The regime has to be proactive in order to maintain its legitimacy and to prevent popular protests from bubbling up and threatening. In Libya, of course, Gaddafi maybe had revolutionary legitimacy when he first took power in the late 60s, but he maintained his regime through terror and through oil wealth, which he was able to distribute to his friends to people to win their support. Libya was a rich country, and there were only 6 million people, and with very, very substantial oil revenues. But of course, he lost his legitimacy as well. And the new regime is starting from scratch. And it'll be very, very interesting to see in Libya the competition between the different groups now over who should be the one that leads. And probably there'll be a competition over their revolutionary legacy. Who did more to topple Gaddafi? This happens all the time. You know, when someone, the morning after a revolution, starts the fights to win the next battle, in other words, to take power. Real legitimacy, of course, can only be achieved by genuine establishing institutions which are the foundation of democracies, as we know them: rule of law, separation of powers, the civil society, protection of minority rights, protection of the individual rights, all those things. Now, where in North Africa can you possibly have such chances for institutions to develop like that? And what about the Islamist movements? Because Islamist movements are on the rise everywhere in North Africa. And can Islamist movements at all be part of this game, if you will, to accept the rules of the game of democracy? These are old questions, but now they become very, very relevant because Islamist movements are, in fact, taking power in some places, or they are now at least very much active players in the new order that is evolving in Tunisia, in Libya, and they will be, in Egypt as well. And finally, if we talk about a general challenge in Morocco, in the Maghreb, it has to do with the question of language and culture. Although Arabic is the official language in all these countries, these are actually multilingual societies. And there are tremendous debates over what language you should even use in these countries. What about French? What about the Berber dialects? What about the Berber populations of North Africa? 40% in Morocco speak a Berber dialect, 20% in Algeria, 8 or 9% in Algeria, in Libya, and it's actually in Libya where the Berbers, the forgotten Berbers of Western Libya, played an important role in battling Gaddafi as part of the anti-Gaddafi forces, and they are now saying, "Hey, what about us? We want recognition for our language as well." So this too is part of the demand for recognition by a more self-conscious ethnic group. Adds to the flavor, if you will. Adds to the mix of challenges in North Africa, and in fact in Morocco, as part of the proactive measures that the king has taken to forestall the protests that have taken place. They actually passed a new constitution which includes recognition of the Berber language as an official language of the state alongside of Arabic, and with a commitment to pass a basic law to promote the development of that language. I know of no other core self-defined Arab state that has officially recognized another language as an official language of the state. This has been a demand of Berber activists for many years, and it's a historical development, although implementing it, you know, is the next challenge. In any case, that's part of the picture. Now, let me use the remaining time to highlight some developments in the various countries. 20 years ago, the esteemed political scientist Samuel Huntington identified Tunisia as the most likely candidate for among Arab states to join what he called then the third wave of democratization. This was a time that states in Eastern Europe and South America were moving into a new phase in their history involving the building of new democracies. And he identified Tunisia at that time as the most likely candidate among the Arab states to be part of that. What did Tunisia have? What was its democratic potential? It had and has a historically rooted, well-defined national identity, socially and territorially. It has a relatively strong educated middle class. It had achievements in promoting the status of women, equalizing to a greater extent than anywhere else in the Arab Muslim world. Tunisia is the only country in that regard that officially bans polygamy by law. And that goes directly against the Quran. Now, most Arab countries, most Muslim countries, in fact, in the Middle East and North Africa, make it difficult for people to marry more than one, to have more than one wife. They've put restrictions on it. But to ban it is difficult because there's a very strong argument that's very fundamental. It says if the Prophet Muhammad had more than one wife, how can you ban this? It goes against Islam. It's basic. So modernizers had to try to find all kinds of ways to make it more difficult. Well, in Tunisia, the president of Tunisia, Habib Bourguiba, in 1957, the new Tunisia had just become independent, he said, that's it. We're banning it. We're going to be a modern country, and no one will marry more than one wife. This will be part of the promotion of the status of women. And in fact, on his tomb in Tunisia, to the door to his tomb is inscribed three or four basic sayings, like an epitaph, a great liberator and builder of the modern state, and the third one, liberator of women. And that, you know, that was his message. So this is not insignificant. Really, Tunisia maintained, under Bourguiba, maintained its distance from the radical Arab nationalism. That also was, which was being promoted by Abdel Nasser in the 50s and 60s. That was also important. And at the same time, Tunisia's heritage is part of also belongs to the Arab Islamic world. There's a Tunisian political scientist that talks about Tunisia's syncretism, its ability to blend different influences from Europe, from the Arab and Islamic world, to do it in a way which somehow manages tensions and doesn't lead to explosions. I mean, every society has tensions, every society has contradictions. How do you manage them? How do you create a society where people agree on the rules of the game and compete, but in a way that you know is more inclusive and more open? Well, Tunisia, to a certain extent, has that potential. We don't want to overdo it and idealize Tunisia, but this ability to sort of combine different elements, but one shouldn't ignore those features of it either. And the big challenge today in post-revolutionary Tunisia is to build institutions and promote societal dialogue in ways that will allow the centripetal forces to outweigh the centrifugal, to manage the tensions and put people on a common path as opposed to breaking up. In fact, the first phase from the time of the overthrow of Ben Ali to the latest elections were very impressive. And I have written a little bit about this, and actually It wasn't easy, but they actually ran a successful election with agreed-upon rules, and they got people out to vote, and they allowed political parties to compete, and they gave them equal time. And these elections are considered to have been legitimate, expressing the will of the population. What did they do for these elections? They're still in transition. They voted for an assembly which will write a new constitution and choose an interim government. And at the same time, they will, and then there will be another election eventually after you write the constitution. Writing the constitution means there's bargaining, there's dialogue. It can be very painful, this kind of thing, and this is a big challenge. How do you write a constitution to manage the desires of advocates of women's rights, of secular Tunisia, of modern Tunisia, and the Islamists? And the Islamists, of course, are the big winner in the elections, the Ennahda party, which won about 40% of the seats in the parliament. They will be the leading force in the new Tunisia, but they will also have to bargain. They will also have to be in dialogue with the other forces. And it's a moment, actually, and everybody's going to be watching. Can you have both more democracy, genuine democracy, one that enshrines these sort of rules of the game, which allows for, you know, even rotation of power? Can you have that with an Islamist party playing the leading role? Again, this Tunisian political scientist, I don't know if you know him, a friend, Larbi Siddiqui, based in Britain, he talks about the Islamist movement in Tunisia as being soft Islamism. And indeed, a lot of the doctrines that have been promoted by the Ennahda party are softer versions than what we hear of Islam, than what we hear from Egypt and from further in the Arab East. They talk about commitment to democracy, about rule of law, of no intent to implement Sharia law and to overturn what happened, what Tunisia has done in the last 50 years. But they also appeal to unabashed religious sentiment in their campaigns, and certainly on Arab-Israeli issues, Middle East conflict issues, they're just like everybody else. Like all the other Islamists, and praising suicide bombers and all that. Is that relevant to Tunisian politics? I don't know. But Tunisia will be tested now, and the Ennahda movement will be tested as we in the next phase. It seems that perhaps that Tunisia is on a path for both greater genuine democratization and greater Islamization. And how is that going to exactly work? What will be the exact mix? We don't know, but it's to be watched. Now, in the few minutes that we have remaining, because I want to leave time for questions, I'll just be really telegraphic. Libya is next door to Tunisia, as you can see on the map. Tunisia is everything that Libya is not. Libya is everything that Tunisia is not. Tunisia is a well-defined, coherent, relatively homogeneous state with a long history of a collective identity and you can see even by what's happened in the last year, there are strong forces that work for dialogue and for managing social tensions. In Libya, the Libyan state never really existed as a corporate entity, and everyone just now united in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi, but Libya is a collection of tribal and regional factional interests with different views on religion as well. There is a strong Islamist component there, and we've already seen that the new prime minister has made a declaration that he's going to roll back Gaddafi's strictures against polygamy, and he's going to allow it. I mean, why did he have to say that right away? And everybody's like, oh my God, why is he saying that? Well, you know, it doesn't bode well. That also, of course, everyone is concerned about Libya because of the a kind of an anarchical situation where a lot of people have weapons, a lot of factions have weapons, and weapons are leaking. And we already know that we've seen weapons leak already to Sinai, even to radical Islamist groups and even Al-Qaeda groups. Hopefully the intelligence services are on this, but you know, I mean, when you start seeing reports about missing shoulder anti-aircraft missiles, it's a cause for concern. In any case, building up a stable Libyan government to me looks like an almost impossible task. And it will certainly require a lot of international involvement to make sure that things don't get totally out of hand there. Morocco, as I said, and as I've written about it, it's coming out in the next Middle East Quarterly. Morocco so far has dodged the bullet. The king managed to be proactive enough to talk about reform and to give the appearance of carrying out reforms. The protest movements in Morocco were ones that generated some interest in the street, but Morocco has organized political life there, political parties, even though they don't have a lot of power. They're sort of appendages. They compete for the favors from the palace, from the king. It's multi-party politics, but without democracy. Now the new reforms talk about greater power to the prime minister, more power to the parliament, more civil society, more human rights, more dialogue. Again, the verdict is out, but for the moment, the protest movements have had the steam taken out of them. Also, the protest movements, which were originally involved both left-wing civil society groups, Berber groups, and Islamist groups, have split now. There's differences, tensions between the Islamists and the secular protesters, and that makes it difficult to mobilize people. You know, after the suicide that sparked the revolution in Tunisia, there were copycat suicides in Morocco. But you know, it didn't trigger the kind of reaction. It's a different context, and the king does have legitimacy there that he can call on. People are not so keen to go to the streets and overthrow a regime. You don't know what's coming next, and the Algerian example is always in people's mind, because in Algeria in the 90s they had sudden democracy and the whole place exploded and the Islamists nearly took power, and they had elections which were not properly prepared, and in the end the military intervened and you had a civil war and the Moroccans are afraid of that kind of sudden sort of radical change. Algeria is a rich country. It's the world's fourth largest exporter of natural gas. Its central bank recently announced that it had currency reserves of $173 billion. But Algerian people are poor, and they're alienated, and they're frustrated. And there isn't a day that goes by in Algeria without social protests, without some kind of demands, without fingers being pointed at corrupt regimes, at military and civilian mafias which are stealing the country's wealth blind. It's all there. I mean, people talk about it all the time and they protest all the time, but there's also no stomach for a return to the 90s, and there's a fear, again, of the Islamists coming back. In general, I think most analysts feel that Algeria may witness some kinds of substantial rumblings sometime in the next 6 or 9 months, in the spring. But again, that's just sort of a feeling. One can not say, you know, what will happen. The Algerian president has promised reform. He hasn't delivered. He seems to be just going on more of the same. And he plays the terrorism card, by the way. Since 9/11, the Algerians, who used to be very anti-Western, anti-American, rebranded themselves as an important ally in the war against Islamist terror. And they did so. Their rebranding was quite successful, I think. And there is security cooperation now between Algeria and European states and Western states. And this took pressure off the Algerian leadership from making real reform. But ultimately, in my view, there has to be some movement as well to change the status quo, because if you, again, it's kind of like the pressure cooker. If you leave the top on too tight, too long, it blows. If you just release the top of the pressure cooker suddenly, that also can blow. You know, you need to have some kind of middle way. That's what the Moroccans have done, you know, fairly successfully. The Algerians haven't done it very successfully, but they need to do it that way. So, actually, we're over time, so just let me, I want to leave time for questions, so let me just sum up. North Africa, two regimes were toppled. Tunisia, Libya. One regime has taken proactive measures, Morocco, and it's they bought time. The Algerians, not much going on there in terms of reform. Status quo seems kind of unstable, but not immediately, you know, about to blow. In all these places, the old rules about society and state, about the societal groups just accepting everything the state does or being afraid of the state, those rules seem to have been modified. There's less fear, or it seems, than in the past. Islamic movements are on the rise everywhere. The consequences of that rise differs from country to country. There are other forces, more modern, secular liberal forces. They're not in the majority, but they're not insignificant in Morocco. They're not insignificant in Algeria. They're not insignificant in Tunisia, which means that there has to be some dialogue, a complex bargaining taking place within these different social forces, as well as involving the existing elites. I mean, there are military security establishments and economic elites. They're not going away either. And so, can Tunisia continue to set an example? Can it be? Can it first continue to move on to greater, more genuine democratization? And can it do it by combining with a soft Islamic movement playing an important role? Can the Moroccan monarchy continue to reform? Can Libya function as achieve any kind of normalcy for the first time in its history? Is upheaval coming to Algeria? I leave you with a question. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Fascinating talk. I mean, so many ideas running. I'll just put one or two quickly and then I'll put a question. I mean, first of all, of course, you won't find the opposition to not naming what happened in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, at least not in the forum. I mean, we never viewed it as a spring in any shape or form whatsoever. I mean, winter of discontent is much better, I would say, definition. Now, the rise of Islam, I mean, people are suddenly surprised. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, if you saw, about Stephans today discussing this issue. I mean, why are the Muslim parties or Islamists, as we call them, rising up? I mean, you know, I think Americans should have thought about this after the experience in Afghanistan, that they supported the so-called Islamists and then they got them at home. I mean, the Middle East is a deeply devout region, and Islam is embedded in the Middle East fabric in the way that it's not in the West. And if you let them run their natural course, it will all be Islamist. The fact is that over the last 80, 90 years, you had regimes that pretended to come with various other ideologies, but they are very thin veneer, and they eventually just started collapsing, and that's what we see today. That's at least my view. Now, I'll come with a question. I mean, you said that basically two regimes were toppled. I mean, I would say that one was toppled, the other was pushed from the outside. I mean, Gaddafi was not toppled by the Libyans. Had you left it to the Libyans, you would have suppressed it very quickly at a much lower cost than the human cost that eventually was inflicted by the Western intervention, with much less damage. So I would even argue, but obviously you are much greater expert of this region than me, that my sense is that most Libyans would have liked to see Gaddafi remain in power. But of course, the Western intervention shuffled the cards, and today we have a different scenario that you don't seem to be much more optimistic than me.
Should we take a round of questions?
No,
first?
One by one.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, toppled. The regime was toppled. I mean, I would say in Libya it's a combination of in and out. In fact, the Western intervention prevented Gaddafi from winning.
Yeah,
and it gave huge support, of course, for the. Without it, there's no toppling of Gaddafi. I absolutely agree with you on that. But the opposition to Gaddafi was fierce. I mean, I would disagree with you in saying that most people would have liked him to stay. I don't think that we have any clue. Can speak at all about public opinion in Libya, what people want and what they don't want. It's clear that in Libya that there was a lot of anger that they built up in recent years in certain areas, different tribal groups and clans, especially after these massacres in the prisons, and that's what touched off the whole revolt in the first place. That thousands were massacred and nobody said anything, and there was no justice being done, and they went out and demonstrated, and Gaddafi repressed them, and that's when the whole fight started in Libya. That there has never been a political community in Libya which wants anything. I mean, which we can say, we are the Libyan people. It was interesting to see that the flag that the anti-Gaddafi forces adopted was actually the flag of the old Libya, of the monarchy. The Libya became a monarchy, independent in 1951. It was a very loose government. I mean, the central government was so weak one couldn't speak of this. Without oil, there is nobody would care at all about Libya. Now, the Americans had a big Air Force base in Libya as well in the 50s and in the 60s. It was part of their defensive alignments against the Soviet Union, the Wheelis Air Force Base. But without oil, nobody cares. Nobody gives a damn about Libya when it comes down to it. So the oil helps, sort of create kind of structures of society and educational system and all that. And Libyan people benefited from that, and that was especially after Gaddafi took over. But I don't think that. Again, there's no polls. We can't say Libya.
No, I didn't mean, in a democratic sense. What I'm saying, that the alignment of tribes that were favorable to him, the fact that it took 6, 7, 8 months to topple him, not a very strong army, with such massive international support.
No, but the international support was, was from the air. It wasn't, you still had to, there weren't a whole lot of, there were some boots on the ground, but not a lot. I don't know. Look, they go together in my mind. I wouldn't say I don't think you should take away from the people who fought on the ground. The Libyans themselves fought fiercely. In Misrata, in the West, whatever. I mean, people mobilized. Ordinary people took up arms. I mean, it was a kind of like let's get in on it, let's get in on the winning side. Probably a lot of people were like, oh my, it's scary to join a revolution. Most people don't want to do that, but push came to shove, and people went for it all, and they got it. Now, is there a Libyan people? Is this enough to create an identity by which people will form institutions and agree on the rules of the game and build a new state? I doubt it. I was impressed by some of the spokespeople. I mean, obviously educated abroad, there is a Libyan diaspora. People know English. People have some training as oil engineers, and but is that enough to really build a society? I doubt it. To build a functioning government, so it's going to be messy. It'll be messy. I don't think it'll be it'll be Somalia, but it'll be messy. Yes.
Isn't the major problem in this area feeding the people from domestic grains? Because in Egypt, not in this area, but they're importing in excess of 40% of their grain. That's a horrible national debt.
Yeah, I mean, food security is an issue, but in the modern in modern day intertwined economies, you don't have to necessarily be self-sufficient in food if you can sell other things, or Saudi Arabia tried to be self-sufficient in food, and what it meant was that they drained all their underground water resources, and they it was costing them a fortune to grow crops. I mean, it didn't make sense. You import the food. I don't want to make light of this, but the population pressures and the change in the change in climate. The advancing desertification on the one level, and the strain on water resources because of the expanding population and without proper management of water resources, makes it difficult to have a good functioning agricultural system that can provide the basis. But Egypt's been importing wheat from way back from the Nasser period. I mean, people aren't starving in North Africa and in the Middle East. This is not the region for all of the problems that people have. It's not starvation. This is not Ethiopia, Somalia, Southern Sudan famine. People, if people, are hungry, it's because their economies aren't functioning properly, so that the and because a lot of there's so much graft and corruption that the matters aren't being run properly. So therefore, the basic staples have to be subsidized, which is a drain on your resources, and then you raise the price of a bread, double the price of bread from 2 cents to 4 cents, and now everybody goes crazy. So, you have to feed the people, but you have to develop more efficient kinds of agriculture. Israeli drip irrigation technology is being used, in the Middle East region. People recognize the value. The value of the technology to use water more efficiently to grow produce crops. Gaddafi had the great man-made river, which was this huge project to bring underground water deep in the Sahara sand, below the Saharan sands, and bring it to the coast. It's an enormously expensive project, and it's a bad idea. Food security, climate change, environmental degradation, these are all hot matters. I would say people in the Middle East and North Africa are just starting to realize the importance of green, of going green, of preserving their environment, but. You need to have strong, strong states, who make it a priority. Matt, please.
Yes, given your description of conditions now in the Maghreb, what would you suggest should be the United States position going forward?
I would say, look at countries on a case by case basis. This is not a place that should have a heavy military presence. I don't think there's any kind of need for that. You have to when it comes to dealing with radical Islam, be aware of what's going on. Have good intelligence. Try to develop kinds of security mechanisms to be able to handle what's happening there. It's a tough thing to say because some of it is very noxious. I'm not a big fan of the rendition, the capturing of Moroccan or Algerian nationals. In Afghanistan and handing them over to be tortured in Morocco or in Algerian prisons. I'm not a big fan of that. I'm not sure that that's the way to go. Clearly there is a security dimension that needs to be addressed, and it has to be done on the level of intelligence, I think, first of all, and finding the right mechanisms to deal with specific matters. On the political issues, Morocco is sort of the poster child for America. Maybe overly so. It's idealized. It's this country that knows how to manage all the competing pressures. It's evolving. It's relatively open. It has institutions. It's engaging in reform. It allows, and there the Americans are doing a lot of things on the ground, sort of local initiatives, microfinance, women's education and health, Peace Corps kinds of stuff, good civil society kinds of institutions. That's very much on part of the American agenda, and I think it's good to do that. I think it's absolutely good to be involved in those kinds of things. There's a limit, and it's always a tough call. What should I'm not a big fan of the United States, wagging their fingers saying, you must do this, you must do that. It's a tough call. I think the American policy towards Egypt was incoherent. I still don't understand what happened.
I don't think they understand what they did.
Well, I've heard different versions, I felt that the Americans needed to speak less in that, and because the image that was given was that they abandoned an ally. That's bad. That's very bad. You don't want to be seen as abandoning allies. you know, should the United States have, you know, told Mubarak, go ahead and crush the opposition? I don't think they should. I'm not sure that would have been the right thing to do either. Maybe, I don't know. I'm not a policymaker. I'd probably be a terrible one. Because, you know, I see both sides of things. You know, I'm an academic on the one hand, on the other hand. I mean, these are tough calls, and I think it has to be on case-by-case basis. The Libyan intervention was kind of easy, I think. Easy in the sense that Gaddafi was the guy everybody loved to hate. And I think the Americans and the Western powers all felt like that they needed to prove something to the rest of the region that they were also going to be on the side of the revolutionaries. So they're going to go and so let's support the Libyans and prevent the Libyan people from being massacred, you know, being hunted down like rats, as Gaddafi had called for. But really, this was, you know, let's be for regime change without really thinking through what might happen afterwards. But it was a tough call. I mean, honestly, it was a tough call. I mean, you know, what would it have looked like if he'd gone in and massacred people? You know, there are consequences to doing it that way as well. In any case, it was the Europeans that really sort of, I think,
they didn't do it because they're worried about massacring people. I mean, you know, Saddam Hussein massacred hundreds of thousands of Kurds.
That's right.
And the French didn't move a finger. I mean, Sarkozy has domestic problems.
Right.
You know, today they have the Greeks don't accepting the loans. What do you know? Tomorrow they'll go to another Middle East country because of this. I'm putting it in a bit cynical way, but... It was basically domestic politics, and Obama from behind.
And maybe that was the right thing to do in this case. Maybe.
I mean, if you ask me, I wouldn't have intervened. I would have allowed Gaddafi to suppress them.
Right. A lot of people are saying we should have left Gaddafi in. You know, should have left Gaddafi in. On the other hand, America's, you know, staunch allies. Where do America's real interests lie in the Middle East? They lie in two things. One is ensuring the free supply of the oil security from Arabia. Oil security, and the other is Israel, defending, you know, working together with an ally with that shares common values. And out of that comes, you know, checking the radical currents, the Islamists, the whatever currents might challenge those things, the Iranians, you know, etc. I mean, you know, the Gulf, you look at the Gulf, the Gulf people, maybe they waited to see if the ones they saw were, you know, that the Europeans were intervening, but you know, the Saudis are thrilled with the overthrow of Gaddafi. And the Qataris participated, and the UAE. I mean, in other words, our Gulf allies wanted Gaddafi to be overthrown. And maybe, you know, these Gulf allies are so worried about the Americans having seemingly abandoned Mubarak and thinking that they could be next. And there's always this concern that the Americans are going to cut a deal with Iran behind their back and leave them, you know, hanging. You hear that, too, in the Gulf. So this is almost a, you know, kind of a way to show our Gulf allies, like, don't worry, we're with you, you know, we're on the same side. And I mean, it's complicated. There's no, I don't have a simple answer for you on this. You had a question here, sir? No. Yes, sir.
Yes, I have two questions. One is, how successful do you think these countries will be in protecting minority religious rights, especially Christians and Jews? Making the Jews no longer, but not there much. And secondly, if they eliminate these populations, how does that affect the growth of their economies? Are they a sort of a driving force in the growth?
Well, North Africa at this point, I mean, that question is really is important on a symbolic level for the North African countries that we've talked about, but not for the practical level. The only place where there's a significant minority, a non-Muslim minority on the continent, is Egypt. I haven't talked about it yet, but there you've got a real issue about the situation of the Copts, what happened last month when 25 Copts were shot by the security forces in a peaceful demonstration. I mean, the Copts are very, very nervous, and if Copts leave Egypt, this will be very damaging to Egypt economically, for in terms of their status in the society? Is it middle class and parts of the elite? And also in terms of its image in the in the West, and that will have a very negative effect on, overall on Egypt's economy, I think, and Egypt's political standing. So, I mean, every time there's tension between the Copts and the Muslims, you know, the government tries to intervene. It's the Copts are Egyptians just like us. We have to protect their rights. But it's going to be an on, you know, it's there. The tension is there, and I don't know which way it's going to evolve. I would assume that, you know, you know, there will be constitutional protections, but will Copts really feel protected, or will they vote with their feet? They're already, people are leaving. In North Africa, there are no, there aren't any Christian populations to, you know, of any significance, and there isn't any Jewish population of any significance. 1,000 Jews in Tunisia, 3,000-4,000 Jews in Morocco, but Morocco promotes itself as a tolerant country that's open to different peoples and to different religions, and in fact, and in fact, the new Moroccan constitution defines Morocco as a country that is Arab and Berber, Amazigh, the word for Berber, and also it says in the constitution it is a country that has been enriched by streams coming from Andalusia, that's to say from the Islamic Spain, coming from the Mediterranean region, and the Hebraic tradition. It's in the Moroccan constitution. Again, you may say, oh, it's just, so what? I mean, it's just words. But it's, but you know, writing that in the constitution is meaningful. There's a symbolic meaning to it. It's a message to its own society. It's a message to the Jewish communities, what's left of the Moroccan Jewish community, and also those who are outside of Morocco, the Moroccan Jewish diaspora, and to the West. It's all part of Morocco's sort of desire to be somehow different, open, a more open, tolerant place. Again, you know, I can't imagine any other member state of the Arab League recognizing the influence of the Hebraic Ubrani, says in Arabic. Hebraic in French, and it's understood that to mean Jewish. That's what it means. I can't imagine any other country across the Arab Muslim Middle East which would include that in its constitution. So it's very important for Morocco to maintain that. Now, you've had Islamists and conservative, not just Islamists, but conservative Muslims, I mean, traditional conservative Muslims, like you talk about. This is, Islam is deeply rooted. You don't have to be an Islamist to be a pious Muslim and believe that Islam should be the guiding doctrine of how you shape your society. You've had issues in Morocco about missionizing, Christian missionaries, Western Christian missionaries have been active in Morocco. I don't say they're having great success, but they're there, and it's created issues in Morocco among the Muslims, and there's been quite a lot of talk about it in the press. Well, you know, they had a rock concert with a Christian rock group, and a lot of people went. Young people like to go hear rock and roll, you know, and how can you can't allow this? It's against Islam. They're going to, it's an easy button to push. Some of the state said, go ahead, do it. I mean, there are issues there. It's not so simple. Sometimes, there are church groups that complain that they're not getting, they're not allowed to operate, they're being discriminated against. Certainly, the Moroccan Constitution guarantees religious freedom. Again, but you have to implement it. The more that countries like Morocco and Tunisia the more that they can promote an image of tolerance and openness and show that it's not just words, but that it really means something, the better off they will be in terms of both themselves and in terms of their relations with the outside world, because they do need these are countries which interact with Europe. They're in Europe's front yard. In fact, their own population, some of them are already in Europe. I mean, so there's a dynamic, an interaction there that needs to be cultivated. And there needs to, the greater tolerance there is, the better. I mean, there are cathedrals in downtown Tunis and Algiers and in Rabat because they were built by the French. So, but they're still there. They're open. I mean, you know, I mean, it's not easy to promote religious tolerance in these countries, but, you know, they need to do it. There is a certain legacy for doing it. Some people understand that they need to do it. And this comes back again to the, you know, forces of, you know, how much can these countries, what's to be the mix between modernity and tradition? Each country has to kind of work it out for itself. Yes, sir.
I believe you've written in the past about the affinity between the Amazigh populations towards Israel. And I want to know if you could expand on that a little bit for the audience here, and especially in light of the changes that have now occurred in governing structure of some of these states. Is there a possibility that there will be some pressure to enhance that relationship based on those populations?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that the Berber identity movement is a mass move, okay? But you know, the fact that Berber intellectuals can get out and write in the newspapers and challenge Islamists on things, including about Israel, tells you something about the society and how comfortable they are. There is a sort of an affinity among some Berbers with Israel, both a kind of a sense that you know that they Jews lived amongst them, you know. That they might have even been Jewish at one time before they were Muslim. There's among more militant Berbers, there's a sense that, well, that we're not Arabs. The Israelis are not, the Jews are not Arabs, so therefore we have common cause. There's a recognition among some people of respect and admiration for the revival of a national language. That's a big issue for Berbers because they're concerned about language loss. When you lose your language, there's a feeling you lose who you are. You stop being Berber when you become Arabized. So we want to learn from that. You know, there was a delegation that last year, a Berber activist from Morocco came to Israel for a week-long seminar on the Holocaust at Yad Vashem. I mean, you know, and it was public and it was in the press and they went back to Morocco and they talked about it and they took heat for it. And they, you know, these are not, even if it's, you know, let's say, you know, going against the grain, it's not insignificant as far as I'm concerned. I think it's part of the picture. You know, to say that this is going to lead to a change in, you know, in government policy, that would be way too far. I don't want to make it into more something that it's not. I think we're about to, we're just about out of time. We are out of time. Maybe one more question if I have. Or comment? Yes, sir.
Okay, I've been reading lately about the potential of oil exploration, oil expansion in Libya, that it has been estimated that there is a tremendous amount of oil underground still in Libya that has never been exploited to its fullest extent. I've heard that there have been estimates that it might even rival the amount of oil from the Saudis. Gaddafi just never exploited it to its fullest extent, and that would change the whole ball game, I think. I think there'd be a mad rush on now from all the Europeans, from China, from Russia, to get in there early and get the rights to dig for the oil.
The interesting thing is that actually Libya, under the monarchy, before Gaddafi took power in 1969, was exporting 3 million barrels a day. And under Gaddafi, in the last years, they were only doing 1.6 because of, first there were sanctions, and because of mismanagement, and because of difficulty getting spare parts, and all kinds of things. Libya needs a lot of money for reconstruction now. There's been an enormous amount of damage that has taken place.
It's there
if they can get it to market, and you need to have stable government. You need to have companies don't want to come in if they can't be assured that their people are going to, you know, not just if the people are going to be able to operate, yeah, you know, safely. That comes back to politics.
Yeah.
I don't think that we can speak about Libya. I've never seen that about Libya's reserves rivaling Saudi Arabia's. according to a study by a colleague of mine, just came out the other day, 46.5 billion barrels of oil reserves, the largest in Africa, and 55 trillion cubic feet of natural gas reserves. That's a lot, but it's I don't think it compares to what the Saudis have. But there's money to be made, for sure. We talk about why the Europeans are there. Of course they're there. And it's good oil, too. It's sweet oil, meaning that there's low sulfur content and costs less to refine, and it's also close to the market. I mean, this is why the Italians are involved, and why the French are involved, you know. Well, China wants resources from everywhere, but it's a long way to transport Libyan oil to China.
China has become involved in Africa.
Yes, absolutely. Now, no question.
All over Africa.
No question about it. Libya is of interest because of its oil, and will continue to be. And I think Gaddafi probably thought that because of that, he had an insurance policy.
And yet, I mean, last year he was in the G20, yes, having an army with Obama. And
well,
Sarkozy,
it turned out not to be an insurance policy. It turned out not to be an insurance policy, or I don't know, the policy expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you.